broadcasting live from beautiful, historic Marion, Ohio, it's Now with Scott Spears on WWGH 107.1 FM. Call Scott live on the air anytime at 740-383-9944. No topic is too big or too small. I'm your announcer, the man with the golden voice, Ted Williams. And now, here's your host, Scott Spears.
Golden Voice Ted Williams, Scott Spears along with you here on this Wednesday, April the 27th, 2022, 17 minutes past the hour, and whatever you're doing this hour, if you're listening on radio, take the knob off the radio, throw it out the window, whatever listening device you're listening on, put a piece of tape over it, do whatever you have to do so you don't miss this. This is a very special hour. Let me give you a little background here. Our guest this hour does not do interviews very often, so we thank her extremely for doing this interview, this hour interview with us this morning. She is probably the best actress in the history of daytime television, and I will back this up. In the top 50 soap actress poll of all time on WeLoveTheSoaps.com, she was voted number one. She has not been on this show since, I believe, 2005, when she was portraying her iconic role, and it was an iconic role, of Stephanie Forrester on The Bold and the Beautiful, which she did so well for 25 years, picked up 3 Emmys for that award, and can you believe this year marks 10 years since she has left the show. As I say, she doesn't do interviews very often, but we miss her. We want to hear from her, and her picture is still hanging on the Bold and the Beautiful set every day for all those people who watch that show. What a pleasure it is to welcome to these microphones, for the first time in, I think, 17 years, the legendary Susan Flannery. Susan, thank you so much.
Well, I'm delighted to be joining you. How's the weather back there?
You know, not too bad. Up and down in the Midwest for April, but we've been more on an upswing lately.
I'm happy to hear it. So, yes, it was much to my surprise that I realized this past summer, or this past Christmas holidays, I was retired 10 years. It doesn't seem possible. Where the hell does your life go?
I know. 10 years. That's amazing. Well, what have you been up to in the last 10 years?
You know, everybody asks me that, and I always say to them, a little of this, a little of that, but don't ask for any magnificent, you know, adventures. I've just been kind of living life and realizing how fortunate and how lucky I am to have this this retirement. It's just great.
You know, Susan, so many people, especially actors and actresses, don't retire. If a role comes along that they like, they will still go out and do it. They might slow down, but they don't retire. You use the word retirement. Is this a retirement?
Yeah, it is. Forgive me. I'm up so early this morning that I still have a frog in my throat, so please forgive me. Well, you know, when I said I was going to leave, I just kind of didn't realize that life was going to slip by quite so quickly. But I've been, you know, really kind of lucky. I'm one of those very fortunate people that belong to a union. You know, the Screen Actors Guild and AFTRA. And it's enabled me to be retired. And I'm just so, I just count myself lucky. And you probably are going to say to me, did you ever think that you would enjoy retirement? I never thought in my entire life that I could walk away from doing something that I loved so much, which was acting, and never look back.
So if a role came today, even if you liked the role, you wouldn't do it?
Probably not.
Is there any reason for that?
I think you just move through different phases in your life. You know, it's like nowadays, I have an 8-year-old grandson. I tell him, the life that you have that's coming towards you as you grow and become an adult, you're probably going to have three or four, maybe five different careers. I think, you know, the world's changing so quickly and rapidly with technology, and has been for the past 35 years, that, you know, you just have different venues, I think, that you will end up in. Does that make sense?
It does. It's you know, there is life to be lived outside of a career.
Well, I mean, a career is your life, and I see what you're saying. And it's not even a question of living outside. I think at certain points in your life, you just kind of say, I think I'll move on and do something else. I did some directing afterwards. I had been directing on The Bold and the Beautiful over the years, and I enjoyed that. But, smelling the roses, taking care of the chickens and the bees is just really a lot of fun and something that I really enjoy.
When you were working on Bold and the Beautiful and doing acting, was it hard to have time to do things that you wanted to do, spend time with family, do hobbies, read books?
That's one of the great things about doing that daytime television. It really, and anybody, you know, any of the other actors that you've interviewed over the years would probably tell you the same thing. It enables you to have a really kind of regular life, because it's a schedule. You know, you go in at a certain time and you come home, you get home in the evening and all that sort of thing. So it's great. You can raise kids and just have a normal kind of life. You know, a lot of people play golf on weekends or go camping, you know, all that kind of stuff that you normally do.
You know, Susan, we talked about how this year marks 10 years since you left Bold and the Beautiful after 25 years. There was kind of a shakeup going on there at that time. Ron Moss, who had played Ridge for 25 years, departed not too long before you. And a lot of people were surprised that you were leaving the program. Was there any particular reason that at that time you felt it was time to go?
Well, yes, there was. And it was exacerbated by, you know, kind of a tricky situation. The whole of daytime had changed. Everything was, you know, as you know, a great many shows went off the air. They changed formats on the networks as to what they wanted to do and how they were making money. And, I mean, it's just a question of economics. And they came to the four of us, Catherine, Kelly, Lang, Ron Moss, Ron McCook, and myself. And they wanted us to all take a pay cut.
Oh.
And I guess you can say that two people didn't, and two people did. And Ron and I just decided that it was time to move on in life. So we did. But it wasn't based just on an economic issue. It was also based, I should say a salary issue. It was based in some ways on an economic issue from the point of view that the quality of what we were filming and the way we were filming was changing so drastically. They couldn't get away with it with me because I wouldn't tolerate it. But for the younger actors, it was very difficult for them to stand up and say, no, I want to do another take. And that's, you know, it's an unusual, individualistic kind of art form, the soap opera. And you just have to, the thing that you have to give to the audience is the very best performance you can, because they're so vested in the characters and the stories. And you can't do shortcuts when it comes to performance. You can do shortcuts maybe in costuming and sets and decoration of sets and stuff like that. You can find other places. But it's the audiences, it's our gift to the audience, is the performances.
That's very interesting to know. If the pay cut had not happened and the changes had not happened, how long do you think you would have stayed with the show?
Maybe another year, and that would have been it. After a while, you have to know when to exit the stage gracefully.
You know, there was a great celebration, like none other that I can remember in daytime television when you departed. There was a big party at the studio that was put online. When they realized that you were going to leave because of the economic issue, did they try to keep you at that time?
No, because as Mrs. Bell told the boys, Susan never threatens to do something. She just does it, so don't waste your time. And I didn't leave with any animosity or anything, just a lot of love and thanks. And Bradley Bell is just one of the all-time great showrunners, just like his dad was, Bill Bell. And they were wonderful to me. I went to them and I said, please don't give me a party. I would prefer instead if you would make a contribution to, in my name, or not even in my name, in the show's name, to Planned Parenthood in Santa Barbara, where I live, and the Santa Barbara Food Bank. And I said, but don't give me a party. It's, let's have a little champagne on the stage and say goodbye to everybody, and that'll be great. And do you know what they did? They gave $25,000 to Planned Parenthood and $25,000 to the food bank here, which I thought was just so extraordinary. You know, they did it for the 25 years I was on the show, and so we left on very good terms with one another.
Mm. You know, it's interesting, Susan. I'm in the grocery store from time to time, and I look at the magazine rack, which is continuously getting smaller and smaller because of the internet world.
Yeah.
But the soap opera digests and books are still there, and every few months there is a rumor or squabbling in there that Susan Flannery may come back. They want her to come back. They miss her. Her picture is still on the set, kept alive 10 years after she departed the show. Is there any circumstance that you would ever come back to do anything in person?
Probably not. But we all know in life, never say never. Right now, I can say no, probably not. But you never know; something peculiar could happen. Does that make sense? Maybe back as the ghost when Eric dies, or something. But not that I really would. But I'm just saying, you never know in life.
Well, it's interesting because I have never seen, and maybe somebody could correct me if I'm wrong, in which a cast member departs a show and their picture is still on the set as big as yours is 10 years later. Are you surprised by that?
No. In a way, yes, and in another way, no. Brad Bell, as I said to you, the showrunner and writer, he's just got a knack about keeping certain things going. I think it's very important to him that there's a thread that goes back to the beginning. That he likes to keep alive in his storytelling. Yeah. So that, in a way, it doesn't surprise me.
Let me ask you this, Susan, and as you have talked about the changing landscape in daytime television, there aren't too many daytime dramas left now. I think only three are left. And heaven forbid Bold and the Beautiful ever would receive a cancellation. But if they were going to do a last episode, would you come back on those terms?
Oh, gosh, I don't think so. Then you're taking away from the kids and the people that are on the show now, and it's not about one character. It should be about if they were to be taken off the air. It's about the whole history of the show. Does that make sense?
It
would kind of overshadow things in a way, and I don't think that would be fair to the people that have worked these past 10 years so hard.
Were you happy with how your character departed the show dying from cancer?
Oh, yeah, because he had laid that the foundation for that 2 or 3 years earlier story. Yes, I thought it was fine, yeah. I wasn't really, in all honesty, pleased with the last sequence, the way we shot it, but that's okay. It is what it is, you know.
What about the?
I don't think I've actually voiced that until just this moment.
What was it about the last sequence that you didn't like as much?
Oh, I think probably it lacked a certain simplicity in the storytelling of the moment. It became more about the scenery, and sometimes. The simpler the scene is, the better, and the more realistic it is, especially in daytime where you no longer had the budget where you could do, traveling down to the Bahamas and doing all that stuff and falling off the boat. You know what I mean? The simple storytelling is sometimes with a big impact, like a death would be, is simply just... just telling it, you know, easily. Does that make sense?
It does. If you could have written or planned the scenery in that last scene, what would you have liked to have seen?
Well, this sounds like I have a lot of regrets, and I don't. I just was sort of commenting, but I suppose I think... That's interesting that you asked me that. You caught me off guard. or perhaps I allowed myself to be placed off guard by bringing it up. I think when I was a kid and we started out doing soaps, and they had no money, you know, I mean, it was like doing theater almost in front of I'll tell you one story. When I left Days of Our Lives, which was the first show that I did, they gave me, the Corday family said, what would you like as a gift? And I said, oh, I don't want anything. Thank you so much. And they said, no, let us do something. So I went back over to Mrs. Corday's office at Columbia Pictures. And I said to her, here, I said, bronze, one for you and one for me. And it was a pair of shoes that I wore. I think I was on that show 7 years. I'm not sure. Every single day because we had no money for costumes. And I'm sitting here in my living room and I look over and there's that bronze shoe in a bookcase. And that just goes to show you the difference of what the style was in those days in the 60s. And I bring that up because sometimes the most interesting scenes were what we used to call the coffee cup scenes, where, you know, I'd walk in, see Dr. Bill, and he'd see Dr. Laura, and we'd sit down in the supposed commissary, which had two tables in front of a black velour, you know, curtain, and we'd just sit and talk. And some of those scenes were so dynamic, and that's, I think, what I, in looking back, the death scene probably could have been better.
Mm.
I think, but everybody always says that. I never get the best take. All actors are always saying that, you know, oh, I could have done that again. I personally never like to do things again. I like to do it the first time, and it usually was the best time. But that's, you know, just a peculiarity of my personality.
Susan, there are a lot of characters in daytime television and have been a lot of great characters over the years. But the character of Stephanie Forrester is iconic. Nobody would deny that. What was it about that character, that person, that made her so strong, such a strong character?
I think when we first started the show, and I had, Bill Bell had written Days of Our Lives when I was on it. So we had a relationship that wasn't close, but a professional relationship. And I went in and talked to him in his office. And I said to him, when in developing this character as we go along, I said, I honestly think, Bill, the audience will forgive her anything if they know it's all based on love of family. And I said, she just is a fierce person when it comes to her husband, excuse me, who she's madly in love with, no matter what he does, and those children. She's just devoted to the concept of family. And I told Catherine Kelly Lang within the first year or 2 years when she it became quite apparent, you know, Joanna Johnson, who played, what's her name? I can't remember now, was going to leave the show, and that was going to leave Catherine as the young female lead. I said, you know, Catherine, the audience will forgive her anything if she does this because she's always looking for love.
Mm.
You play it that way, and they'll go with you. This audience will go with you 1,000%. That's kind of how it turned out.
How close, by the time you were done playing that character, was she to Susan Flannery, the person?
Oh, gosh, not at all. People always say that to me. She's just like you. And I go, God, no, she's crazy as a bedbug. I mean, how many people pull out shotguns in the Big Bear cabin and say they'll shoot you, you know, or choke you, or you get her thrown off of a balcony? I said, oh, my God, not at all.
Well,
she was fun to play.
At the end of 25 years, when that character wrapped up, is she more of a heroine for people, or was she a tragic character?
Well, I think there's a little tragedy in all of our lives, because we, at some point or other, all the people, you know, in the world go through some form of sadness or tragedy. I never thought of her as a tragic person. I always thought of her as just a very strong and determined person who, and that was one of the great stories that he spun, and I don't know where he got the idea for this, that the father, when they brought Betty White on the show to play Stephanie's mother, that you had this whole hidden background story that nobody knew about. He never told anybody, Brad, this is what we're going to do. He just laid it all in, and that's the beauty of soap operas. You get to, it's like a Dickens novel. You get to really get the knowledge and the understanding and the 16 different sides of a human being in the writing and in the structure of the storytelling. And he laid that all out. And when they revealed that Stephanie had been physically abused as a child, and that the mother had stood by, it was really just so enlightening. You know, it was the audience just loved that story, and they loved having Betty on the show.
You know, I was thinking about that this morning when I knew you were going to be on the show, and I thought, you know, of all the storylines I think I've ever read about or seen in daytime television, that one, because of the storyline itself, was great. But then when Betty White is your mother, it couldn't have been better.
No, it couldn't have been. It was just brilliant casting. Yeah.
Tell us about, we just lost Betty. Tell us about Betty.
I know. Oh, she was, well, in order to tell you about Betty, I have to tell you about the other character in the show, played by Allie Mills from The Wonder Years, who played Stephanie's sister. The threesome, the triangle, and the way they created the characters, laid them out, laid the story, it was just, I just thought, kind of brilliant. when they told us that Betty was coming, I was, you know, I never read ahead. They never tell you ahead. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. Why is Betty White going to play my mother? I was thinking in my brain. And we'd already created this relationship between these two sisters that the audience had gotten sort of pulled into in a not in a big story way, but in a kind of peripheral behavior within the frame of the show. And then when Betty appeared, and all of a sudden I realized where the turn was going with the story, I thought, oh my God, this is great. And it was. Betty was just wonderful. She was one of the funniest people you will ever have met in your life. She was charming and warm. And I worked together for about 3 weeks, 4 weeks maybe, before I sat down with her one day at rehearsal and told her, I said, you won't remember this, but I met you a number of years ago when, you know, she'd been married to Alan Ludd, and he had died. And she was just, oh, so madly in love with him. And that was a tragic passing of a young person, you know, in the earlier years of their married life. You know, they weren't married like 50 years. And pardon me. Anyway, I said to her, I was going to a dinner party that Aaron Spelling was giving for his Love Boat series. He had a whole big group of people that they brought on, Van Johnson and Ann Miller and Bob Newhart, for this big, like, cruise. And there was a party at the Bistro Gardens for a big, you know, a celebration. And everybody was there, and I was going with Ross Hunter, the film producer. And he said, we're going to be at the table with Betty White, and this is her first night out socially after Alan's passing. And so she was seated next to me, and we the whole night. Of course, she didn't remember that because it was like 15, 20 years before. But she was just as charming then as she was on the show and in real life. She just was a really gracious, kind human being. And the last night that we all filmed together, myself and Allie and Betty, we went out, we were down at the Paradise Cove on the ocean because she died on the beach. I said to myself, how do you go and die on the beach? But okay. That was a wonderful death scene for her. It was a great sequence. And so we went and we all had a martini. Oh my God. Thank God we had people to give us rides home. But she was just fabulous. She was just a fabulous person. And Allie Mills is a wonderful actress and a really funny human being. She was married to Orson Bean, the actor, for years. And that was just, Betty was just great. Just great.
Bold and the Beautiful had some great casting when it came to guest stars and bringing them back.
Oh, yeah.
And one of the one other I wanted to talk about is kind of a connection that Susan and I have. This woman was on this show, I think, over 50 times. She might be the most appeared guest on this program, and did her last interview in life 1 month before she died on this program, and did her last.
I hope that's not a portent of things to come.
No. Susan, but now here's the tie to Susan Flannery. She did her last television scene with Susan Flannery.
Oh my God, who is it?
Phyllis Diller.
Oh, she and Mrs. Bell, Lee Bell, were friends. And I had the same story to tell her when she came on the show. Oh my, about having met her like 10 years earlier, 15 years earlier in the business. She, Phyllis Diller was, oh my God, she was delightful and wonderful and just really, you know, great and so witty and charming. Yeah.
You know, that last scene in which she, I think, remarried you and Eric, you know, she was pretty close to 95. She did pass away within 6 months of that, I think. What do you remember about that scene?
Oh, my God, until you told me that right now, I totally forgot it. I didn't remember that she'd done that. She was the minister, basically, is what you're saying?
Yeah, I think that, yeah, she was kind of on the grift. She was, yeah.
Oh, she was always on the grift, the character. That's great.
It's a great scene, and because I was a huge Phyllis Diller fan, having her on the show. But so close to her death to do that.
Well, you just never know. You know, all you can hope is that you pass away in your sleep. Yeah. Everybody wants that. Phyllis was just like Betty, you know. They're the same kind of the same generation, in a sense. Although I suppose Phyllis would have been 10 years older or so. But just, you know, brilliant people. I remember when Betty came on the show, I remembered seeing Betty in the very early days of television when I was a kid, still in, you know, grade school. She was on with Bob, Bing Crosby's brother, Bob Crosby, who'd been a band leader and a singer. And when I'd come home from school and turn the TV on, there they'd be in the afternoons. And I was like, wow, what is television? This is fabulous. I got to get there.
What is it like to be on television? For those of us who have never done it, and in the days before internet, when there were three channels, very little cable, is it hard to go to the grocery store? Is it hard to go out in public?
But you know, people are always very pleasant. I've only had two or three incidents in my whole life where somebody was a little off, you know, balance or offbeat. Everybody I've ever come in contact with that's ever come up to me and spoken to me was always very nice. And there was really a very interesting difference. When I started, between Days of Our Lives and The Bold and the Beautiful, and the impact that each one had. When I did Days of Our Lives, it was 1968, I think, 67, 68, when I went on the air. And that was, you know, as you said, three networks, basically. The people that would come up and talk to me were the people that, for instance, all the guys, so many men watch the show, which I don't think they ever picked up in the demographics when they did all their research. There were guys who would watch because they came home from work in the middle of the day or early in the morning shift and couldn't go to sleep right away. And they'd say, oh, last night I saw you. And you'd go like, oh, my God, they were fabulous. There was a completely different demographic. There were more women still at home working. I mean, not working. And slowly over the time, that all changed as the income level and everything in the United States started shifting. And you had not as many stay. By the time I left that show, and over the next subsequent 10, 15 years, so many women entered the workforce. But it was then the next biggest change that I saw when I went to go to do Bold and the Beautiful. Of course, there was so much more. The cable, everything had shifted so dramatically. I'll give you a little example of how the worldwide reach of this show on the Bold and the Beautiful. I went to my daughter lived in Australia, and a friend of mine. Her two daughters and my daughter grew up as best friends, the three kids. And she was from the Sudan. So when I went to Australia, where my daughter lives, to visit with her, my friend has sisters and family in Melbourne. So she wanted to go up into Melbourne and see people. And she said, my family wants to... can you guys come up? They'd like to meet you, Susan. And I said, well, okay. So we went, my daughter, my son-in-law, and the baby and I. And unbeknownst to me, they gave a party for me. I had no idea this was going to happen. They rented the church hall, and they had about 150, 160 people. And all those women that came up to me and wanted to meet me had been absolutely bonkers for the character of Stephanie and this was in the Sudan. This is all through Africa. The show was huge down there. They were absolutely in love with the idea that Stephanie fought and would murder if necessary to protect her family.
Hmm. That's a great story.
Well, I mean, it's just, I was like, wow. I was really surprised. The show was an international phenomenon, you know, for the first 12, 14 years. It's still a big deal all over the world in many, many places, but it was just the impact of it and the storytelling was unbelievable. Yeah.
Was there ever a storyline in the 25 years of the show that you did not like, that you thought...
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely. It was one of the... very few times I ever had a big fight with Brad, the writer. He wanted Stephanie to be responsible for setting up the rape of Brooke. And I refused to do it. And he was really angry with me. I said, I don't care. I said, that, first of all, I said, that's the wrong kind of story. And that's something that Eric and Ridge would never forgive Stephanie for. And neither would Brooke. I said, you can't do that. You destroy the character. He said, no, she's a sociopath. I said, the character you're writing is a sociopath, and the character I'm playing is not. I said, we got a big problem here, and we better sit down and resolve this. So I didn't do it. I refused to play it. He said, well, then you write it. So I rewrote the sequences, the scenes that were involved in that story portion, and when they actually went to film it. Yeah.
Did you?
That's the only time. I just didn't. I said, first of all, you know, raping women on television is like you should not be doing that. Not in the sense that it's something that you're trying to, you know, on a social storytelling level, trying to get a change in people's minds and foment some sort of action that helps women and saves women. I said, this is just salacious, and I'm not going to do it.
Did you have a favorite storyline?
Oh, I thought in the very beginning, this is one of the stories that Bill Bell wrote and came up with. I'm guessing he came up with it. And that was when Stephanie got amnesia and went to live with the homeless people. And that was in, I think, the second year of the story of the show. And I just thought at the time, it was a really important story to tell, and we had some wonderful actors. Now, you're going to ask me the names of the actors, and I'm sorry, I'm not going to be able to remember it, but it was a wonderful two people that played the story with her. It was a black actress who subsequently has passed away, but she was just wonderful. I wish I could remember her name. And an actor who they sort of fell in love with one another. He was homeless and on the streets, and that was the thing, the quality that Bill Bell always wanted to infuse in his storytelling, was trying to comment and make the audience aware of a social issue that was really sort of starting to surface in the country, and to give them some knowledge of it, and without preaching. And I thought that was one of the most important stories that we ever told, was the beginning of the awareness of the homeless situation in this country.
Mm. You know, yeah. Television is a very interesting medium, because you come into people's homes, and in a daytime drama, 5 days a week. When you come into people's homes, people feel like they know you. What don't we know about Susan Flannery?
What don't we know about Susan Flannery?
Yeah, what would we be shocked to find out?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. I wish I could tell you something fabulous. I don't know. It's true. You know, especially when I did Days of Our Lives, on the run of that show, I did that show 5 days a week for, I was in every episode for the first 4 or 5 years that I worked. And he did the same thing with Ron Moss when he launched Bold and the Beautiful. Ron was in every single show taped for the first four or five, maybe 5 or 6 years. And that's how you build such a strong character when you do that. You put them there in front of the audience day in and day out, never missing a day. I don't have any special things that they, you know, maybe they'd be interested to know I like chickens. I have my chicken coop. I take care of my chickens and my bees.
Certainly not a bad way to go in life. Three Emmy Awards for this character. What's it like to win the Emmy?
Oh, well, I sound like a spoiled child. Ian Buchanan, the wonderful actor who played Duke on General Hospital for years opposite Finola Hughes, he and I had a lot of scenes together, and we became fast friends. We'd finish a scene, I'd look at him, and I'd say, never going to get nominated on this show. I sounded like a spoiled child. But it was like 13 years, I think, before I got nominated for an Emmy. And I said to him, you have to go to the Emmys with me and be my good luck charm. So he did, and I won that first time that I'd been nominated. And I was really, I was delighted. I had won 25 years earlier for Days of Our Lives. And I thought to myself, God, 25 years between. Well, I guess I just better shut up and say thank you and be lucky, happy. winning is nice. And anybody that says it isn't being truthful. It's great to win. I think human beings are competitive by nature. You know, you have to go out and get the, when you're on the hunt, get the biggest gazelle to bring back to the tribe, or find the best place to pick the best berries. You know what I'm saying? If you're gathering food. It's great to win. I'd be the first person to tell you that. It's really nice. I suppose you think of it in terms of an affirmation from your peers, because it's all voted on. Way. It's not sort of a random sampling of things. It's, you know, people have to go in and check off the box with your name following it. And it's great.
It's kind of interesting. In the next 3 years after you won that first Emmy for Bold and the Beautiful, you won two more Emmys for Bold and the Beautiful. In the last year, you were on the series. You were also nominated. Did you want to win that last year knowing it was the last year?
Oh, it would have been nice, but the stuff wasn't good enough, in my opinion. So I thought the nomination, I was very pleased that I got nominated. I thought that was very, very nice. I did not expect to win. I think Heather Tom, and Heather is a wonderful young actress. Yeah. Yeah.
Do you watch the series?
I just remembered, because I just flashed a picture in my mind. Kelly Lang is also nominated in the supporting cast. I was very disappointed that Catherine didn't win.
Do you ever watch Bold and the Beautiful?
I only watch it when, this sounds terrible, a very dear friend of mine who's English, who's watched the show from the very first day because we're friends, and he's watched this for years. He comes and visits with me every once in a while, and he absolutely drags front of the television set at 12:30 California time to watch it. And I sit there and I go, oh my God, I can't believe they're doing this. Oh my gosh, I can't believe they're doing this. Yeah. So, but he loves the show. And people that, you know, as you say, you're in their home 52 weeks out of the year. And people start to think of you like as a neighbor. Or a friend, yeah.
Absolutely. Just a couple quick questions here. This one a little self-serving on an interviewer's behalf. But Susan, since you retired, you are known as somebody who does not really give interviews, does not do this sort of thing. Why is that?
Well, what have I got to say? I'm surprised I still keep talking to you. I was worried when I woke up. I thought, oh, no. How am I going to talk to him for about 50 minutes? I'm tired. I haven't got anything exciting. we're not doing the show, you know, and that's what he's going to want to talk about. I don't do interviews just because you're the only person I've done.
Yeah, and I
remembered when you sent me the request, I thought to myself, I think I did his show a long time ago. Radio is, you know, it's fairly easy to do. The only other thing that I've done was we had the 30th anniversary or 35th anniversary, I guess it was the 30th anniversary, of the show launching in Italy. And we did a Zoom call, Catherine, John McCook, Ron Moss, and myself. And I've seen Catherine on and off most of the time. Am I going on too long?
No, we're good.
Okay. Catherine and I see each other, you know, at least once a year we try. During the COVID, it didn't work out so well. But anyway, I hadn't seen John, and I hadn't seen Ron, or spoken to either one of them in 8 years. And we did it just during the COVID thing. We did a live Zoom talk to Italy for the fans and for the anniversary. That's the only other thing that I've done.
Well, I feel honored that you have done this, and you were on a few times when the show was still on the air, and we always had a good time when you were on. That's what I remembered. And I thought, it's such a shame that we can't do this anymore. Susan, final question here. How do you want people to remember you on the screen? They're going to remember you for several things, but how would you like to be remembered?
Well, just as someone that they enjoyed watching. And someone that delivered a really good performance for them, that it pulled them into the storytelling and into the suspension of disbelief for that time that I was on the screen and they sat in the audience or they sat on their sofa and watched, and that they enjoyed themselves.
Well, Susan, as I say, I know you don't do these things pretty much period, except this one. I cannot thank you enough. I've enjoyed you so much over the years. We more than filled the time. I really do think you are one of the best actresses, daytime, nighttime, anytime, that there ever has been. You have been extremely interesting this morning. And we didn't even get to talk about Darlene Connolly or your starting.
Oh, my God.
Your start in.
All-time stuff.
So, yeah. Susan, will you promise me at some point that you will come back?
Well,
Maybe. Well, maybe is better than no.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. You were very persistent in a very lovely way, and I'm delighted to have spent this time with you and with your audience. And thank you, Scott.
Susan, thank you so much for coming on. Stay well.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
The legendary Susan Flannery. There you go. I'm heading for the dugout. Glenn Coble coming up next.
This is WWGH Radio 107.1.